The truth is that we are in a climate emergency. We have less than 10 years to make substantial changes to our society and way of life and our economy.
I want to stress from the outset that this pandemic is far from over.
Those who have never fought for the colours they fly should be careful about criticising those who have.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
Good afternoon, I'm Ewan Potts. Chancellor Rishi Sunak says he's not comfortable or happy about the UK's tax burden. According to the Resolution Foundation, the average household will pay £3,000 more in taxes every year thanks to changes made by the government. The think tank says that real wages will likely fall next year and the country is in the midst of its weakest decade of pay growth since the 1930s.
Well, the Chancellor insists that he intends to reduce taxes, although he's not committed to doing so before the next general election. Sunak has been following up on his budget yesterday with a media round this morning, reacting to concerns from some Conservative backbenchers about a £75 billion increase in public spending.
My ambition is to lower taxes for people. That's what I would like to do as Chancellor. We had to take some corrective action as a result of the crisis and the response we took to it. But, you know, hopefully that now is done.
So that was Rishi Sunak.
Now is Gareth Davis, Conservative MP for Grantham and Stamford and a member of the Commons Treasury Select Committee. Thank you so much for joining us today. The government's Office for Budget Responsibility says the tax burden is set to rise to its highest level since the 50s. Are you comfortable with that?
Well, great to be with you and thank you for having me on. Clearly, as the Chancellor's been saying this morning, we've come out of a very, very difficult period because of the pandemic crisis, the biggest recession we've seen in 300 years. And so it's inevitable that we have increased strains on public finances, and that requires taxes to rise. And nobody's happy about that. Of course, I'm certainly not, neither is the Chancellor. But I think certain taxes have had to rise to pay for things like the healthcare backlog as a result of the pandemic. But as the Chancellor has made very clear, he intends to reduce taxes as much as he can. And we saw yesterday he's already started to reduce taxes, right? So business rates are going to be cut in half for about 90% of retail businesses. Working families are going to get support from the taper relief on universal credit. So I think there's a lot there to give us hope that in the future we can look to reduce taxes even further. And indeed, he started yesterday.
Gareth, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which has given their response to this, says that the policy choices that Sunak has made are largely, in fact, in their words, almost entirely unrelated to the pandemic. It's actually the Chancellor responding to ever-increasing demands in terms of the healthcare system and also putting money back into things like justice, social care, prisons that were starved of funding during the austerity years. This has nothing to do with the pandemic, is their argument.
Well, they're entitled to their view, but I think the facts are pretty clear that we have a pretty significant backlog of elective patients who weren't able to be treated during the pandemic. And clearly there's a cost to helping to reduce that and clear that backlog as quickly as we possibly can. And as the Chancellor's made very clear, you know, we have to pay for that from somewhere. And so the IFS are, of course, entitled to their view. But I would also just point out that a lot of the spending that was announced yesterday is to shore up our public services, but also innovation and research and development. You heard about a $22 billion increase in research and development by 2026. This is investment that will help us grow as an economy, create jobs, and ensure that we get the debt burden down.
How worried are you about inflation and interest rates? The financial markets expect a rate rise in the coming months. Do you think the government should take the blame for rising mortgage rates if and when they come?
So this is something I've been talking about a lot, Ewan, the risk of inflation. Bank of England, obviously, and the Fed and other central banks around the world have consistently been saying that they believe it to be transitionary. A number of us have been worried about it for a long time and how long the transitionary period it is, right? And as the Chancellor said, inflation is a reality at the moment. It's driven by issues with supply chains and rising energy costs. But I would just point out, this is a global issue. This is these are two global factors that are helping to drive inflation, and we should be absolutely mindful of that. If rates rise, obviously that's a Bank of England, independent Bank of England decision, but we in the government, we in politics have a role to play to ensure that families are supported through things like the rise in national living wage, the universal credit taper relief, things like that. Those are the things that we can help families with as inflation does rise. But, you know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's not a concern. Of course it's a concern for anybody that lives in this country, but it is a global concern.
Is there a philosophical shift here? Is this a kind of seismic moment in terms of the Conservative Party? Are we moving to a big state Conservative Party in the face of an ageing population and Brexit here in the UK? Is that something that you feel that you know, Conservative leadership means big government?
I think this Conservative government has shown that it is willing and able and prepared to support the economy, support workers and businesses when things like a global pandemic strike unexpectedly. And we saw that with colossal support that has helped, you know, thousands of my businesses and my constituency and workers through things like the furlough and the grants and you know, things like the CBIL loans. That was important to get us through the crisis. Of course it was. And I don't think anybody's suggesting that it wasn't necessary and it wasn't the right thing to do at the time. But as we've seen, that worked, right? So unemployment is a lot lower now than it was expected by a number of these think tanks. Same with growth. Growth is a lot higher than it was expected. So the plan worked, but it's right that we now are very mindful of public finances, sustainable public finances. And that's why yesterday the Chancellor announced new fiscal rules to require us, you know, that in the future we'll only borrow to invest and seek to get debt falling by 2024. I think it's really important. I don't think there's a philosophical shift in the Conservative Party. I think it's exceptional circumstances caused by the pandemic required an unprecedented response to help our economy stabilise. That's worked, and now it's important that we now get on with supporting growth through things like R&D and innovation.
It's certainly been an exceptional period, but do you think that the government is planning to bring down the tax burden and the debt burden quickly enough over the coming years?
So my personal view is that obviously we as a Conservative Party have a very strong reputation with the British public for managing sustainable public finances. It's one of the reasons we were able to provide such unprecedented support during the pandemic. So, you know, my personal view is obviously that we should be seeking to control that debt as much as we possibly can, as quickly as we possibly can. But as I've said many times in the Chamber of the House of Commons before, at the moment, borrowing is not necessarily a bad thing, so long as that borrowing is going towards things that will help us grow, help us equip a new generation of skilled employees up and down the country so that we can level up. So, yes, of course I want the debt to go down. The Chancellor has laid out how he's going to do that in the next coming years. But it's also right we invest for growth to improve productivity that will also help the debt pile go down.
Okay. Of course, it could also fuel inflation, which will also be, you know, of benefit in the sense that will also reduce the government's debt pile. But I also want to ask you this question. Is this government really supporting long-term growth? Because I thought it was quite fascinating that the OBR, which is the fiscal watchdog, the chairman of that, Richard Hughes, said that the OBR is assuming that Brexit, leaving the EU, will cut the long-run GDP of the UK by around 4%, the pandemic by 2%. So Brexit is still there as a massive economic hit long-run.
So, of course, the OBR are fully entitled to their view. They had, you know, views 6 months ago on where unemployment would be and growth would be, and those unfortunately turned out not to be that accurate. So they're entitled to their view. It's their job to make such you know, predictions as they see fit. But what the Chancellor announced yesterday very clearly was that we're trying to take advantage of the opportunities and freedoms of Brexit. So we've already announced, I think, over 60 new trade deals across the world. We've announced free ports up and down the country, and we're reforming our taxation system, which we weren't able to do before, which will reduce the cost of beer in pubs and all sorts of things like that. So, you know, from my perspective and what the government is focused on is capturing the opportunities of leaving the European Union so that we can grow our economy in markets that are growing as fast as we are, if not faster. And so I want to see these trade relationships expand to you know, places like the Indo-Pacific, which is a really exciting part of the world that we hitherto haven't been able to forge as close a link as we're going to.
It's just days until the most important environmental summit in many, many years. Do you think it's right that the government's cut tax on domestic flights and frozen petrol and diesel duties?
So I think there's two parts to this. First of all, in terms of freezing the fuel duty, I think for the 12th year in a row now, this is very important as part of the the debate around cost of living for working families and people who need to get to work. Certainly areas like mine in Grafton, Stamford, you know, rural areas in particular, you know, you need a vehicle to get to the shops, to get to school, to get to work. And so it's important we, particularly in this environment, we are mindful of that.
Well, let's have a look at what else is making news in the world of politics. The UK has hit back at France over its proposed retaliatory measures in a dispute over post-Brexit fishing rights, calling them disproportionate. France says it may disrupt the flow of trade with Britain unless more of its boats are given permits to fish in UK waters. The UK maintains it's granted 98% of licence applications from EU vessels since Brexit.
Meanwhile, when it comes to COP26, Barbara Woodward, Britain's ambassador to the UN, has conceded that a big deal on ending coal burning, a key goal, is off the table at COP26. Alok Sharma, the president of the conference in Glasgow, set a target for the summit to consign coal to history in order to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial levels. But G20 diplomats are now narrowing in on a much more modest plan to stop governments funding foreign coal-fired power plants. That's according to people familiar with the situation.
While sticking on the green theme, the UK's chief scientific officer says that tackling global warming will take behavioural changes from all of us. Sir Patrick Vallance says we need to eat less meat and to fly less, as well as harness green technology. He joined colleagues around the world in urging leaders to make landmark pledges at the COP26 climate summit next week.
So those are a few of the bits of news in the world of politics this morning. But let's go back to digesting, really, Rishi Sunak's budget. How does it break down in terms of tax? Firstly, of course, taxes in Britain are now expected to hit record levels next year. The Resolution Foundation has said that tax bills for households will be £3,000 higher since Boris Johnson became Prime Minister. The Institute for Fiscal Studies says that the tax changes, though, are highly progressive, because lower earners benefit from things like the increase in the national living wage, whilst higher earners will be more hit by the increase in national insurance contributions. Well, joining us now to look at all of this in detail is Duncan Simpson from the Taxpayers Alliance, which actually campaigns for a low tax economy. Duncan, welcome to the programme. Sunak is spending now, promising tax cuts later. This can't be what you want to see from a budget.
That's right. I think he's having his cake and eating it. I mean, obviously there were these allusions from the Chancellor in his speech yesterday to speaking to his desire to be a tax-cutting Chancellor a few years hence. Obviously he was putting this within the wider context of the economic reality, though much improved compared to where we were a year ago. It's still pretty bleak. But obviously before that, and then having gone through the budget documents, I mean the overall picture for the economy is not brilliant. I mean, as you were saying, the historic nature of how taxes are changing is really quite dramatic. I mean, we went through the data from the Office of Budget Responsibility, which has basically compiled a lot of the figures which the Treasury then uses for these documents. And at the moment, the current spending plans for the Prime Minister, he would leave office with the highest tax burden compared to any of his predecessors going back to Clement Attlee. The tax burden is effectively national account taxes, so all taxes, relative to the size of the economy. And we're seeing that increase basically from this year and every year out to 2026, 2027, so right through the remainder of this parliament. And so obviously it's particularly jarring that, you know, the Chancellor, in as much as he has made when he was a backbencher, junior ministerial post, that, you know, he's got a very clear desire to see the low tax and, well, or rather lower tax, lower spending economy. The reality of the plans which were laid out in the spending review, so that's a three-year process, run entirely counter to that. So, yes, it's bad. There's much analysis which has been done by others to say the Resolution Foundation on sort of a household basis, but the broad macro picture of what's going to be happening to the tax system right now in the next few years is not particularly good from our perspective.
Does the government really have much choice when it comes to public spending? We've had the best part of more than 10 years of austerity for most government departments. The NHS has been protected, but most other bits of the government have had very, very tough settlements. Is there really more to be trimmed on that front?
We'd say so, yes. I mean, again, that was another sort of disheartening aspect of what the Chancellor, you know, didn't say with this. We know that across all departments, the average increase, the departmental spending limit will be increasing by almost 4% over the course of this parliament. In a real terms, change, that's about £90 billion from where we were 18 months ago towards to the end of this parliament. So that's a pretty sizable increase. Now, there's numerous reasons for that, not least, for example, the 0.7% target for foreign aid is being returned in, I think, 3 years' time compared to the 0.5% at the moment. But, you know, it doesn't bode well in terms of the desire, or rather the indifference of many seemingly in government towards various areas of the public sector, which we know through our work and other groups' investigations of how poor their spending can be with procurement decisions. One big department, for example, which is getting a big big increase in their tax revenue, is the Ministry of Defence. Now, the Ministry of Defence obviously has pretty vital work to do, but we see this time and time again with massive procurement projects, be they buying aircraft carriers or new fighter jets or you know, basic essential equipment for soldiers. They mess up these procurements time and again. So it's concerning for us, because if it were to be the case that the Chancellor were sort of acknowledging that, yes, the tax burden is very high indeed, and the rationale for that is in part because of the, you know, the debt stock has increased quite dramatically because of COVID in the preceding years. But if the counterpoint were to be, but we cannot go on just expanding the state basically ad infinitum, which is what the budget documents show. If that argument presented, then I think it would be slightly more relaxed. That doesn't seem to be the case from the government.
Okay, I think it's interesting that you point out defence spending, because actually relative to previous decades, defence spending is a smaller and smaller slice of the pie in terms of government spending in the UK. I mean, the real issue is that we've got an ageing population, and as well as the pandemic, you've got to deal with all of that. Philosophically, do you think that there is a big change going on, perhaps because of that ageing population, that the UK is moving now to big state conservatism? Certainly the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Simon Clarke, has called it a philosophical shift.
Yes, I saw those. I saw those comments from the chief secretary. Rather, it is. It's axiomatic that as a country, many of the Western countries, well, countries across the world, we will by definition be spending more on healthcare with an aging population. That's obviously not for dispute. Obviously, the makeup for that, however, the whole purpose of the tax system has been modified and tweaked. Obviously, we've got the health and social care levy, which is being introduced from next financial year. Seemingly, that's going to be a temporary measure to do two things, one of which is to clear some of the backlog for waiting lists, and the other is to assist local authorities and other deliverers of social care for that in the coming years. Frankly, I think that's for the birds if it's a temporary thing. I mean, I think this is, by all intents and purposes, an increase in national insurance, not merely on employers, but employees as well, sort of all categories of national insurance. So, yes, we are going to spend more on healthcare, but the, you know, perpetual argument, which we see time and time again under this government and previous administrations, different parties have, you know, demand some more NHS cash without a deeper look at the system. Could we, for example, move to something more tried and tested, either in the Netherlands or Germany, with some degree of co-payment between, yes, a lot of public spending on healthcare, but some degree of insurance, which you're paying into from a relatively young age when you start working. To have that debate in this country is not something that we've really done for years and years. And I think, yes, the ratcheting up of healthcare obviously is going to happen, but we're not really looking at the system of delivery and how individually we may be paying that for that in the future. And that's certainly a concern of ours.
How worried are you about council tax increases? Last year, councils put up bills by 4.4%, a lot more than inflation at the time. The budget small print suggests that a lot more money is going to be raised by council tax over the coming years. How much of a concern is that for you?
It very much is. I mean, obviously, others' analysis are saying that budget decisions are somewhat progressive. Now, that's certainly true to a certain degree. If you look at the overall picture of how all taxes, direct, so income tax, national insurance, and indirect taxes, VAT, beer, duty, and so on and so forth, how that breaks down on individual deciles, so you know each 10% of the population. We know that the poorest in this country, so the bottom 10 and 20%, proportionately pay a vast amount of their post-tax income in council tax. So, yes, there are limitations on councils' ability to increase council tax across England, at least, without triggering a referendum. And basically, it doesn't happen. The councils generally try and max out what they can legally without triggering that referendum. But if it is indeed the case that councils having, I think, probably where we were maybe 8 or 9 years ago, kind of atrophied with, deciding not to increase council tax, and that was a good thing, if they are continuing the trend which has been happening across the UK for the last 3 or 4 years with pretty substantial increases of sort of between 4 and 5% when you factor in social care, that's certainly worrying. And obviously, there's different degrees of delivery between different councils. Local authorities have varying responsibilities rather compared to central government. But yes, it quite rightly is a concern.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.